Radio. We're Radio Verulam in West Harts.
Welcome to the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parents Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia Elcourie.
And I'm Naomi Love.
Now, tonight's show is all about childhood and how the modern world affects children's development and learning, and more importantly, what we can do to minimise the effects of the modern world on our children. Now, first up, we'll be talking to Sue Palmer. And for those of you who don't know, she's the author of Toxic Childhood, which is about the effects of contemporary life on child development and learning. And it was in the Amazon bestseller charts for 2 years. And she followed that by writing Detoxing Childhood and 21st Century Boys.
After Sue, we'll be talking to Wendy Elliott from the Save Childhood Movement. The Save Childhood Movement is a collaboration of individuals and organisations that share a deep concern about what they call the profound erosion of childhood that has occurred over the last few decades. This erosion, they say, has resulted in a modern generation of children that are disconnected not only from their love of learning, but also from their innate sense of self-worth and belonging. The Save Childhood Movement says this has created a culture with increasingly high levels of childhood depression and dysfunction and profoundly compromised child well-being. And the movement aims to identify and highlight those areas of most concern, to protect children from all inappropriate developmental and cultural pressures, and to fight for their natural developmental rights. It aims to provide a critical platform for dialogue and debate, and to unite those individuals and organisations already calling for change.
So, lots of food for thought here. And if you have any questions for us, please email us in at parentsshow@radioverulam.com or give us a call at 01727 839 926 and we'll put your questions to either Wendy or Sue Palmer in just a little while. So, send in your questions, anything at all you'd like to know about detoxifying your children's childhood. In just before then, we've got a bit of Belle and Sebastian. Thanks again for joining us on the Parents Show this evening. And as promised, the discussion of tonight is all about childhood and how the modern world affects children's development and learning. And we really delight to say that we've got Sue Palmer joining us in just a second. But to give you a bit of background on Sue, she's a former head teacher in Scotland and has written a staggering more than 250 books, educational TV programmes and software packages on all aspects of literacy. Her first book, for those who don't know it, is Toxic Childhood, and it was about the effects of contemporary childhood on child development and learning, and was an Amazon bestseller charts for 2 years, and it was followed by Detoxing Childhood and 21st Century Boys. And just to give you an idea of the reception that Sue Palmer's work has received, apparently Archbishop Rowan Williams and Right Way Long to Anne Fine have called it an essential must-read for parents and teachers alike, and the Independent's Deborah Orr has praised it as imminently attainable advice on how to detoxify childhood. Sue, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, I think every mum I know has heard of the book and is delighted that you're on the show this evening. Now, when you talk about a toxic childhood, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, it was a phrase that cropped up because 15 years ago when I was in my day job as a literacy specialist, I was travelling around the country talking to teachers. I kept hearing everywhere I went that people were worrying about children's attention span, their ability to, you know, sort of control behaviour and various other little niggles, nothing too dreadful, but just little niggles, about worrying that children weren't quite the same as they'd been in the past. And because of that, I started looking to, were there any possible effects that modern childhood, the sort of lifestyles kids lead now, could have on the way they developed emotionally, socially, physically, and cognitively. And there were just so many different things that could impact that I needed a phrase that would sum up a syndrome that would affect some children in different ways from others. But for those children who got too many influences operating on them, it really could be toxic, and that was where the phrase came from.
It's a word I think no parent wants to hear associated with their children, because it's quite loaded, isn't it?
It's very scary, and I remember I used it, and I'd been trying to persuade a publishing agent to, you know, sort of find me a publisher that would take a book on the subject, and he'd constantly said, oh, no, nobody's going to read a book about, you know, children and development and things like that. And when I said that phrase, toxic childhood, he said, that's it, call the book that, and we'll be able to sell it. I'm terribly sorry, that wasn't what I was trying to do, but if you want to get information out, you've got to go with the people who know how to sell it.
Absolutely.
Now, when we hi Sue, this is Naomi. We know that you highlight six major areas of concern in most of your writings, and perhaps you could run through them with us.
Yeah, I mean, as time went on, I mean, there were so many things that obviously at the time I was looking into it in the early 2000s, everybody was very worried about diet and so on. But the six things that really bothered me was first the absolutely startling decline in children's outdoor play, you know, playing out freely around their home in the local neighbourhood, which it struck me had been really the birthright of every child since time began. And it's only been in the last 20 or 25 years that freedom to be a free-range child had completely declined. You know, that was one area that I thought was really worrying, that children were not getting the same active outdoor experiences with their friends that they'd had in the past. And then the second area, which I think was very, very closely linked to that, was the increasing commercialization of childhood. The fact that it was really back in the 80s, it's been documented, that marketers recognized that children were a very, very lucrative market. And gradually, as time went on, as they found they could sell more and more and more toys and other products aimed at children, they also discovered that children were quite a powerful marketing tool to their parents in other ways too. I mean, I remember one thing that stunned me was that somebody in the early 90s discovered that 60% of the cars sold in the USA were chosen by the kids.
God, that's staggering.
So ever since then, children have been used not only to sell things to children, but also to sell things to their families. And the more I looked into that, the more enraged I became, because it seemed to me to be a totally immoral thing to use kids as a sales technique. So the decline of the outdoor play, and then the commercialization of childhood, and then again, sort of running alongside it, was what I've called the schoolification of early childhood. That we started, it was almost as though that competitive impulse that runs under consumerism was making everybody more competitive about their kids. And, you know, I've got to get my child doing as well as he possibly can from as soon as he possibly can. And we've always had a very early starting age for school in the UK, but it sort of pressed younger and younger and younger, that people were wanting to get their children reading and writing and doing sums and things at an increasingly early age. So that nowadays, you know, three- and four-year-olds are being expected to get started on, you know, the basics. And that is not, according to all the developmental theory, good for them. In fact, it's probably very bad for them in all sorts of ways. So outdoor play, commercialization, schoolification. The thing that had originally alerted me, because I'm a literacy specialist, was the particularly in the less advantaged areas of the country, the decline in children's listening and language skills, which had been noticed by speech and language therapists in the late 90s. It took until about 2004 before the Education Department got hold of it, and ever since then there have been sort of initiatives every 3 weeks to try and get kids' language development better. But that area, I think, is linked very much to children's early attachment and their relationships and interaction with adults at a very early age, and that's another issue in itself. And the last two were, first of all, the screen saturation. which had built up again. We were getting more and more sort of screen-based activity through the 80s, not just TV and video, but also the beginning of computer games. And then in the 90s, we got the vast proliferation of channels, including children's channels, and then computer networking and MSNing, and then social networking. And so that now we're in the iPad generation, that increasing exposure to screen-based technology, which one researcher in the USA has said, you know, he said we're engaged in a vast uncontrolled experiment with our children plunging into environments saturated in electronic media. And there is no research, because there can't be, because it's never happened before. But the indications are that it really, the younger the child is, it really the worse it is for them. And my last one is just the sort of tests and targets culture in schools, which again, part of the, you know, competitive element, has made schooling a much more competitive and pressurised issue than it ever has been. You put all these things together, you know, and you have got something that you could call toxic childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to just jump back on a couple of things that you said. With the screen saturation, are you saying, Sue, that there should be none? Should there be absolutely no exposure to television, iPads, or should it be contained? And what's a healthy amount?
I have to say the advice of the American Academy of Pediatrics for a long time has been that the safest, you know, taking the precautionary principle thing is to keep children under three away from screens as much as you possibly can.
Does that mean? Oh, you've made me feel so guilty now. I've got a 3 and a 1-year-old who I left watching in the night garden. Does that mean nothing at all?
Well, the thing is, they do like it, but you know, you wouldn't leave them sitting there with a fistful of sweeties and a you know a range of foods that were bad for them. I mean, one of the problems is that modern sort of competitive consumerism is based on, you know, giving people what they want and saying, you go and indulge yourself, you know, enjoy. And one of the jobs of an adult is to think, well, what is it good for my kid? But I fear that because the whole screen-based thing has happened so very fast and it's just, you know, accelerated the most incredible speed, people haven't had time. And there hasn't been the chance for the evidence to build up. But the research that is available suggests that if a child has a predisposition to a developmental condition, then the more TVs and things they watch under the age of three, the more chance it will kick in. That's the briefly what it sums
right.
up.
Right, so that's more of the extreme.
And from the advice from the American Academy of Pediatrics is that from three through up to, you know, teenage years, No more than 2 hours a day. Yeah.
Okay. That's. I think that's probably a relief to a lot of parents, because that's probably It's quite a lot, actually, isn't it? I mean, two hours.
Well, I'm afraid the amount of screen time, the average amount of screen time per day for British kids now is around about 5 hours.
Really? That's over threes.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, with older kids, I suppose sometimes something that parents worry about is that so much of our working life is dominated by computers and technology of that kind. And perhaps by limiting older children's access to those things, we're actually holding them back from developing important life skills. And I wonder
First of all, can I say that I'm talking about the 3 to 12-year-olds that we should be saying,
right,
you know, strict limits on amount of time. But the second thing is that computer technology, digital technology, is developing at such a rate that any skill your child learns under the age of 10 is going to be out of date by the time he's 15.
That's a good point.
You know, there's no point in saying, oh, no, we're just getting him used to it now. He's not going to be able to, he or she isn't going to be able to avoid screen-based technology. Mm. The big point is to limit the amount of time they spend on it, just as you limit the amount of time they spend eating things that are bad for them. And giving them the opportunity to do all the other things that children have done in the past that have been proved to be beneficial to their overall development. Because the more time they're sitting sort of hooked to a screen, the less time they're doing all the obviously human things that, you know, we have evolved to do, and that children need a whole childhood's worth of experience in order to achieve a sort of a bright, balanced outcome as they grow older. Once they're into their teens, I think, you know, it's impossible to avoid the sort of technological environment. But again, if they've had a reasonable childhood, with any luck, they will have the capacity to use it for themselves, not to be used by it.
Great. And Sue, can I just jump back again to the schoolification of early childhood? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that kind of surprised me. Everybody I know, all the moms and dads I know that we talk about, I mean, nearly everybody talks about how in the Nordic countries, schooling starts later, phonics, mathematics, everything starts later, and they have a much better education as a result of it. If we know that...
And much better outcomes. I mean, Finland is the best literacy and maths results in Europe. Their children in the UNICEF League of Childhood Wellbeing, in which the UK, I fear, came bottom, Finland came fourth. It's got one of the lowest gaps between rich and poor, and it's got the lowest prison population in Europe, less than half per head of population as we have here. So they must be doing something wrong.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's a great model. But why is that? I mean, we send our children to excellent institutions, and they're run by extremely clever people who put their heart and souls into it, and mm-hmm. they know that too. I mean, what would it take for it to filter out and for phonics to be taken out for 3 and 4 year olds and really not to start until later? Is it impossible?
Can I just say that as a literacy specialist, can I just say phonics is important? So it's just when you do it, and the difference in other countries is, and there is a difference in the number of phonemes and things like that, but also it's this recognition that the best way for children to learn until they're about 5 or 6 is just by singing and rhyming and becoming aware of the sounds of their language in natural ways. In Finland, I watched some phonics teaching, more syllabification teaching, actually, because of the way the Finnish language works. But it was just done in ways that were sort of playful and active and always oral. No asking them to write things down.
Yeah.
They don't start formal reading and writing until they're 7. And even though, you know, some children want to do it before that and support them and say, yeah, fine, and give them the sort of support a loving family would give. But they don't actually insist the child picks up a pencil or sits down and does some work in a book until they're 7. And that just gives time for the natural course of development to happen. And, you know, children just sort of pick it up then pretty easily. I think the problem with us is we're starting them so soon and we're putting many children off causing problems that didn't need to exist.
Yeah.
Sue, going back to your writings and some of the things that you say it would be a good thing for parents to do to detoxify their children's mm-hmm. Environment, you talk about the 5-finger exercise, and perhaps you could talk us through that a bit.
That was developed one day. I was saying I think there's 5 things that are really important for healthy development. They always have been, they always will be. And I was holding up my finger and counting on my fingers. And this woman came up afterwards and she said, "Carry on doing that." She said, "You're putting us back in touch with what really matters." Mm-hmm. The 5 things are so obvious, it seems ridiculous to say them, but I think it's just so easy in a modern, high-tech, consumer-driven world. It's so easy to forget them. The first one is very obvious, and the very most important thing for any child, any person, and that's love. No child can survive without love. They're born to love and be loved, and it's at the bottom of all our social and emotional development. So I think what I try to say to parents is that in a market-driven society, we've got to remember that love is not the same thing as indulgence. Which actually leads on to the second thing, which is, I find it so hard to find a word for this, but it's discipline. Sometimes I say boundaries for behaviour, you know, just knowing what's acceptable behaviour, really, and in for a little kid, it's the rules and routines of the home, and then it's learning how to behave when you're out and about with other people and how to behave at school and follow the rules and, you know, what you can get away with and what you can't. It's just that being set boundaries that gradually, as they learn to do what mum and dad have told them, they internalise that idea of self-control and it becomes self-discipline and they can control their own behaviour. So love, discipline. The third one is communication, talk, songs, stories. Children need stories. They need them really badly from a very early age, and they need them carry on all through their childhood, and lots of opportunities to talk and to be listened to. And then the fourth one is a very, very important one. It's play. And by play, I don't mean screen-based activity. I mean active, outdoor if possible, creative, social play that doesn't require any particular equipment. You know, making dents and making mixtures and just messing about with your mates. And then the final one is, on top of all that, you can build education. But without the first four, love, discipline, communication and play, those four are care. And without those four, education isn't going to work really well.
It's crystal clear, isn't it? When you say it like that, Sue, you just think it makes sense.
The problem is, I think that the big problem is that if you think about it, every single one of those five things is free.
Yeah.
And we live in such a consumer-driven, market-obsessed society that we cannot believe that free stuff's important.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
Indeed. I can say I know what's going on in my head. I'm just thinking time. But you have to make time.
That's the only hindrance in
any of these things. Yeah. There's a phrase you used earlier on the show, and I love it. Free range childhood. That really resonates with me. I love it because you think, picture your kids out roaming around a field. You know, it's great, and it's kind of back to basics, really, isn't it? In a way.
It is, and I know how difficult. I mean, this is one of the problems that when I'm talking with parents, you know, it's the big thing that crops up is that the world is different now, and above all, the traffic and the dangers of the road. And my answer always is, well, actually, there have always been dangers, you know, letting your child roam about. I mean, once it was Viking marauders, you know, and then when I was just before I was born, it was German bombs and things. You know, I grew up playing on bomb sites. But what parents have to do is take into account what the dangers are and bring up their children from a very early age to deal with them, because quite frankly the traffic's not going to go away. And our kids have to be streetwise and able to cope and able to get themselves across the road and know where they can go in their local area and where's safe and where's not. So the most important thing, I think, with a small child is, as soon as they're old enough to walk, is walking with them in your local neighbourhood, constantly demonstrating how you cross the road, you know, by doing it, real-life, three-dimensional experience, so that gradually children build up that confidence and competence, and parents feel confident in them, so that by the time they are older and want to go to walk down the street to call on their friend and go to the play park, you think, I know she can.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really sorry, Sue. We've only got halfway through our questions and we've run out of time. But
it's been lovely speaking to you.
Thank you so much for all the information and your advice. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.
All the best.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Welcome back to The Parent Show. We're now going to be talking with Wendy Elliott from the Save Childhood Movement. Now, the Save Childhood Movement aims to bring together all those who are concerned about the current erosion of childhood in the United Kingdom and to assist other countries with the same issues to do the same. and they're looking to identify the core problems and to start seeking cultural and political solutions to them. So we'll go straight into talking to Wendy. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Lydia.
It's Naomi, actually.
Hi, Naomi.
That's fair enough. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Okay, good to talk to you.
And we'd really like it if you'd be able to tell us a bit about the idea behind the Save the Childhood movement.
Well, really, it came out of my own interest in kind of early childhood, which has been going on for about 15, well, actually longer, since I had my daughter. I became absolutely fascinated in how children learn. And about 5 years ago, I set up something called the Unique Child Network, which was challenging some of the influences of the current education model. And then I got involved in something called the Open Eye Campaign, which has been incredibly influential in early years policy making, looking at the early years foundation stage. And really, it was those combination of things, plus looking at the absolutely mounting evidence that child well-being, we've got some serious problems going on that I guess I and others felt people weren't really addressing. And the evidence is coming from all sorts of different disciplines at the moment. So the aim of the movement was to try and bring people together from a kind of multidisciplinary team of people to say, let's have a look at what's going on and start to investigate and kind of move from awareness to action about these things.
Well, that's fantastic. Thanks, Wendy. And we've looked a bit through your core principles, and I'd probably say there's hardly a parent out there that doesn't support what you're doing. Yeah. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about each of them. So the ones we sort of picked out, you mentioned the importance of children's connection with nature. I mean, we've just been speaking with Sue Palmer, and she sort of talks quite a bit about children having more of a free-range childhood. So it sounds like there's a parallel there, if you could tell us a bit about that.
Problems. In fact, the National Trust has just become involved in this, so they've become one of our supporters. They've just done a big natural childhood report. Again, looking at, we've got some very extraordinary things going on in this generation of children, and really we've got the first generation of adults who haven't had a direct connection with nature. We've got, I mean, if we all think back to our grandparents' lives, a significant amount of their time was spent outdoors. And we've now got like a quarter of children not regularly using the outdoors and not connecting to the outdoors. And of course, the influence of digital technology is making that even more prevalent. And the knock-on is substantial from a perspective of not just learning about nature, but nature does something to you. The wonders of nature, just being out in something that takes you out of your context into the wonders of the natural world. But also the lack of physical exercise. I saw an incredible statistic that now children don't even know what wildlife is. And in the National Trust survey, one in three children couldn't tell what a magpie was. They couldn't say the difference between a bee and a wasp, but they could recognise a Dalek.
Yeah.
We've got a very strange situation with the current generation of children, and it's affecting both their well-being in terms of not being out in nature enough and being inside, and it's also affecting their physical well-health because we've got incredible problems with obesity. I know they reckon at the moment, but that if we carry on at the current rate, by 2050, half of all adults and a third of all children will be clinically obese. So the nature is not just going out and having parks, you know, open to children. It's saying to get them out using nature, making classrooms in nature, exploring nature, making things from the natural world. You know, there's so much that children gain from it. And family time, of course, you know, it's another issue that particularly in Britain, families aren't getting enough time together outside. You know, we've prioritised certain things over others. So we're starting to see the knock-on of a generation of children who have had this kind of their rights and their freedoms kind of really restricted.
Yeah, and I wonder kind of when you think about how many sort of large urban centres we have in the UK, how that can kind of work with people that live in inner cities.
Well, there's some wonderful work, and one of the things we're doing is we're bringing together the people who are actively looking at how you can create wild areas within cities.
Oh, wonderful.
And there are two or three different organisations that, and it's part of what the Save Childhood movement is trying to make people aware of the wonderful work that's going on out there. So we try and we're trying to identify the problems, and then we're trying to look for who is actually out there already working in the field. And we'll also start to say, well, if there isn't anybody working in the field, then we'll try to, see if we can get people together to actually to look at these things.
And I'm sure you've got partner after partner lining up to join you on it, because it's such...
Yes, I mean, phenomenal support already, and really, we're very, very new. We're not even officially launching until next April.
That's amazing. And Wendy, give us a taste of who your partners are. You mentioned the Wildlife Trust. Was it Wildlife Trust?
No, we've got some... Woodland
Trust, did you just say?
No, we've got the National Trust.
National Trust, great.
Yeah, they're supporters. I wouldn't say they're partners, because we're just... we've got people like, the Eden Project and all the Play England, Play Scotland, Play Wales, all sorts of different organisations.
Brilliant.
Coming on board. I mean, Sandstart, people to do with children's media, people
great.
To do with children's play. We've got advisors. We've now got more than 25 advisors, everyone from Baroness Susan Greenfield. Because what we're trying to do is say... There's now scientific evidence to say that we're actually harming children, that we are, we really do have to look at this from a neurological perspective, from a physical perspective. We've got the highest ever levels of childhood depression. We've got 1 in 10 children being diagnosed with mental health disorders.
That's just a shocking statistic, Wendy. I mean, you just, and no parent wants their kid touched by that. And again, like as we were talking with Sue, the hints are so basic and they're so easy and so accessible. There's one of your core principles I'd like to jump to. There's one on spiritual development.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, it's a very interesting one, because in early years teacher training, the word is hardly, hardly used at all, if at all used. And I think, it's a kind of damning indictment of the world we live in now, that we're afraid to look at the fact that wonder and awe and a sense of being connected to something greater than yourself is massively important. And that doesn't mean anything to do with religion. It's saying that children have an innate connection to the wider world and everything in it and each other. And it's spirituality coming out from a relational side to say, I went to a conference about a month ago, and it was very interesting because it was Tim Gill talking at the conference, and he said, when you ask an audience, 95% of people, if you say, what's your most extraordinary memory, when it was full of wonder, 95% of the audience would say that's to do with childhood. There's something magical to do with childhood, and very often it's to do with nature. Being in the natural world and a sense of something greater than yourself, that you are part of something. And so it's actually saying, well, what is that? And what are we doing to keep that sense of connection to the world really vibrantly alive in children? And that means family and community, and it means caring about the planet, and it means that you have this sense of something greater, like I said. So we're very interested in bringing together people. In fact, we're just deciding now on who might be the speakers for our conference in April. But of course, some of the greatest pedagogues, such as Montessori and Steiner, were openly talking about this. So it's a very, I think it's a dialogue we need to have.
Yeah.
Why this has disappeared. Yeah.
And the question is, as a parent who isn't in the academic circles that you are, how does that become accessible to somebody, on my level, and how can I translate that into, my day-to-day interaction with my
children? Movement wants to do. That's why we want to bring some of the people that are working in this field. So, how do we ground really practical solutions, particularly for parents? I think part of what I think is really evident is one of the things that we might start looking at, and obviously at the moment we're completely voluntary, so we'll see where we go next year. But I certainly think support for parents is going to be one of our biggest areas of interest. How do you support parents in the UK to actually deal with some of the dilemmas that are extremely difficult to counter, like the digital world, which is both wonderful but also extremely dangerous in terms of what it's doing to child well-being. And we don't really know enough about it. It's moving so fast, and you've got a generation of children who actually understand technology more than their parents, and that's very challenging. for parents.
Absolutely. And sorry, Wendy, I just want to jump to another one of the core principles. These are the ones that have just really kind of jumped out at me. Risk-taking and creativity. Now, as a mother of a boy who's three and who knows everything about risk-taking, are you sure you want to do this?
Well, I mean, that's a whole massive area, how we've compromised. We've made risk into something, like, dangerous, and that is, you know, we're a risk-averse society. And I know when I was working for Open Eye, we even had an email in from one of the nurseries who said they had a wonderful woodland at the bottom of the hill down from the school. And there was a glassy slope and then a woodland, and that was the children's favourite place to play. And then they emailed to say that the whole woodland had been fenced off because it was dangerous because a branch might fall on a child. Well, it's a crazy world when we don't allow children to explore for themselves. A part of what you need to learn is, you know, how to judge risk. If we remove all risk from children, then they don't have the ability to be creative and to be adventurous and to actually measure for themselves.
Okay, I knew there must be a take on it that I didn't see originally. That makes sense.
I think it's quite hard as a parent sometimes with the, particularly with smaller children, with the whole idea of taking risks. I mean, I know I sort of think sometimes my partner and I have conversations in the park where there's a lovely bit of woodland in our local park, and you know, one of us will say, oh, we should let the kids, I've also got an almost 4-year-old, and we should let her go and play in the woods and things, and then you'll think, well, there's little sticky out bits of branches, and to what extent do you go, well, she's taking risks, she's learning how to climb trees, how far she can climb, what she can do, but then what if she just, quite a horrible image, but what if she walks into a sticking out bit of branch and pierces her eye or something? And it's quite hard sometimes to know when you're being overprotective.
I just think about my mother, who was a farmer's daughter, and gosh, if ever there was anyone involved with risk, I mean, because they had the whole farm to
roam
in.
Yes.
I mean, I remember as a kid, it gives away my age, but I remember being given 2 jam jars, and there was a brook down the end of our road, and you went down a bit, and I used to go off with 2 jam jars and be told to be back for tea, and had the most blissful time catching water boatmen and, you know, with wellies. And you simply can't imagine that now as parents.
Absolutely. Or spending hours making pies out of sawdust and stuff like that, you know, in your granny's backyard. I mean, there's, and what it did for your, you know, for your imagination is.
So I think part of the problem is we need to relook, especially the generation of younger parents now, because they're the first generation that have come up through this kind of new way of looking at the world. I think we need to revisit some of the boundaries and limitations that we've kind of accepted because it's the world we've grown up in. But we really need to look at the reality of the risk. And actually, in reality, the most dangerous place for children, statistically, is in their own homes.
Mm.
By far. I mean, that the accidents in the home and the danger children in the home by far outweighs any risk outside, including traffic danger, which is really interesting when you start to look at the statistics, because we think, or we're made to think, that stranger danger and traffic are the kind of big things. But actually, statistically, it simply isn't the case. Like,
right.
You know, being at home playing with kitchen implements or in your bedroom on the internet, you know, there are other dangers.
Mm.
So it's a very interesting world. And part of what I think we need to do is challenge our own perceptions as adults.
Absolutely.
We're not limiting our children.
And so often at the moment, I mean, everybody's trying to be the best parent that they can.
Yeah, absolutely.
And quite often you get to the stage where, I mean, you're hearing this phrase over and over again of over-parenting, where parents are just getting too far involved in their children's lives and not letting them.
Yeah, and children aren't given spaces. You know, we're trying to fill their lives with activities. And actually, children need space and reflective time as much as adults do. You know, I think it's one of another area that's very interesting, and that probably goes back to spirituality, that children need quiet time. They need to be reflective and to, you know, go into places where they're not filled with ballet lessons and homework and you know, endless activity. We live in an incredibly busy world. I mean, it can be very frenetic, especially with the kind of screen influence on screen technology, both television and digital, that is quite a frenetic, almost an aggressive quality to it.
Yeah.
So we need to build in spaces where children can just be. And that's part of the problem, I think, that we've got with the loss of connection with nature, because they were getting that through quietly, you know, pootling around the woods or streams or whatever. So it's how we can reintroduce it in a way that's safe, but isn't so safe that children's natural creativity and kind of desire to risk take is quashed.
Mm. Yeah, it's about that magic word in parenting. It's balance, isn't it? It's all about balance. Now, Wendy, we're running out of time, so just a couple of quick questions before we go. Can you tell us what your movement thinks about children's media? And I think this is one that everybody worries. Like,
commercialisation? We've got the most commercial children in the whole of Europe. There was a big report that came out.
And can I take it on a different level? I think watching BBC, CBeebies or CBBC, is there not some merit in that for your children? Do you not feel that there's some developmental pluses?
I think there can be. I'm certainly not an expert on this. I think it's an area we need to be... It's more about, as Eric Sigmund says, I suspect it's more about the amount of time they're spending looking at things. We tend to be worried about what they're watching, which is, I mean, there are obviously dangers in that, but it's also about the physical amount of time they're watching. And Eric Sigmund would say that we're not paying enough attention to that, because, we're losing social skills and community skills. It's an area, the whole commercialisation, sexualisation of children and children's media, again, are core areas that the movement will be looking at. In fact, we've got... Reg Bailey, who actually headed the government report, is going to be one of the speakers at the conference. So it's an area we really want to look at carefully, because there are wonderful things that are available for children, and then there are very kind of violent and aggressive things. And I think it's the ability, we almost need, some kind of flag system. Parents need more help, that's what I think, with to make choices, so that they're not left kind of making the choices for themselves. There needs to be great if there was kind of more guidance, and that's part of what we can hopefully look at.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, if there are parents listening who've it's really resonated with them what you've been saying, are there ways that they could get involved in Safe Childhood Movement or find out more about it and about the different resources that you have?
Yep, you can go onto the website, which is www.safechildhood.net. One of the things, because we had so many people emailing us to say, could they do anything, we've actually set up an action group resource page.
Oh, fantastic.
So we basically said anyone can set up an action group. You just need to let us know, whatever you call it needs to be, a certain, have our kind of name attached. But we really, the call for us is to let people know what we're doing. You can set up an action group of your own and just let us know, where you are. You can, we've got a Twitter, it's at support SCN, N for nut, not M for mother, SCN. And we've also got a Facebook page, so certainly sharing with others what we're doing. But if you go and have a look at the website, safechildhood.net, that leads you to the conference that we're holding next April, and we've got the most fantastic list of speakers, and I've just been sent an amazing film from the States, because we're getting interest from all over the world.
Sure.
But one of the men who runs the second biggest early childhood facility in Australia is coming over to talk, because he feels so strongly about what we're doing. And this, we've just been sent a film from the States from another group who say, we just love what you're doing, we want to share what we're doing.
Brilliant. So that's in April next year, is it,
it's
Wendy?
The 27th and 28th in London.
Great stuff. So we'll be putting all those websites on our Facebook page. And I'm sure if we haven't liked you, we already will. And hopefully all our other listeners will as well.
Yeah, that'll be fantastic.
Wendy, thanks so much for your time this evening. It's been great talking to you.
Time.
All the best.
All right, take care. Bye.
Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Radio Verulam Community Partners. Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust are the leading voice for wildlife conservation in Hertfordshire and neighbouring areas. with 43 nature reserves spanning 1,900 acres, from beautiful woodlands and wetlands to rare patches of heath and orchard, we take practical action every day to help wildlife flourish. You can help us to protect your local wildlife today by becoming a member and join more than 22,000 others in Hertfordshire and Middlesex who say that wildlife matters to them. For more information about membership, go to www.heartswildlifetrust.org.uk or telephone 01727 858 901. That's St Albans 858 901.
For more on Radio Verulam Community Partners, go to radioverulam.com/communitypartners.
Thanks for joining us again on The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. Now, lots of food for thought there, Naomi.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just something that you end up thinking a lot about as a parent, isn't it? The different effects of the environment around you on your children and what you can do to maximise that, the good things, but also to protect them from the negative impact.
That's it. But the great thing about the conversations we've had with Sue Palmer and Wendy Elliott is that it's very accessible, really, isn't it?
It is, and it's not complicated.
So we'll be here at the same time next week between 8 and 9pm. Be sure and join us. If you get a second, jump onto Facebook, and if you haven't already liked us, please do. All the best. Good.